European nations say Iran violated their nuclear agreement. That could trigger more economic sanctions in a place that's already reeling.
The price of red meat, the price of fish, the price of bread, everything has increased by a few hundred percentage.
Also, the 2014 revolution in Ukraine changed everything there.
It was like a civilizational shift, if you want.
6 years later, the country is at war with Russia and at the center of the U.S. impeachment trial. A Ukrainian politician weighs in. And Harry and Meghan give up the keys to the kingdom for a life in British Columbia.
I think one of the things they like about Canada here is that we just don't care. We're very nice. We're very pleasant. They could probably walk around and not even get noticed out here.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. As if Iran didn't have enough on its plate this week, now add the threat of more economic sanctions on a country that's already mightily struggling. Germany, Britain, and France are challenging Iran over its resumption of nuclear activities. This could lead to UN sanctions being snapped back on Iran. President Trump took the U.S. out of the nuclear deal in 2018, but until now, at least, the Europeans have been trying to keep it alive. Konstanz Stelzenmüller is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Constance, why is this happening now? What has Iran done to push the Brits, French, and Germans over the edge?
The Iranians have made it very clear that they intend no longer to consider themselves bound by the uranium enrichment limits set by the deal. That is crucial for its European partners, for whom that is the whole point and purpose of the deal. To slow down Iranian attempts to acquire nuclear capability, to make all of its nuclear activities fully transparent. And if Tehran is walking back from that, then the agreement is truly in danger from a European point of view.
So what's the goal of the European move?
I think the goal of the European move is quite simple. And the Europeans have said two important things at the same time as they said we are triggering this dispute settlement mechanism. They have said we will not be part of Washington's maximum pressure strategy, and we wish to preserve the agreement. In other words, they're holding out a bridge to Iran to come back over. But they're also making it clear that they feel that Iran has of its own accord crossed this bridge away from them. And the triggering of the dispute mechanism enables the reimposition of UN and European sanctions without the veto powers in the Security Council stopping those sanctions. And that, I think, is a major stick to shake at Tehran.
So we shouldn't interpret the European move as meaning that Germany, France, and the UK are coming around to Donald Trump's way of thinking?
I think not.
Now, despite the European powers having formally initiated this dispute mechanism and challenging Iran, Europe seems to really want to keep the JCPOA alive. Why is that?
The Europeans want to keep the JCPOA alive for two reasons, a good one and a rather less good one. The good reason is that the JCPOA has given international inspectors unprecedented inspection rights into Iranian nuclear activities. And so far, Tehran has not walked back from that as far as we know. The less good reason is that the JCPOA has always been considered a zenith of diplomatic achievement by the Europeans, not just by France and the United Kingdom, who are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, but also by the Germans, who were the third European country in the E3, the European parties to this agreement. And so to some degree, this is seen as a symbol of diplomatic status, which makes it understandably hard for Europeans to step back and view it critically and ask themselves, what is this really worth at this point?
Now, with the European powers initiating a dispute mechanism, there's now 60 days for an agreement with Iran, or UN sanctions will snap back into place. What would a better nuclear deal with Iran look like?
I think a better nuclear deal with Iran would look quite like the old one, to be frank. It took years to negotiate among diplomats who knew their Iranian counterparts very well, who were deeply aware, because they were in possession of good intelligence, of what the Iranians were doing and not doing. And it was also realistic in that the agreement didn't attempt to include Iran's other activities. There is one point, however, that I would suggest that now be included, which is Iran's missile missile capabilities. Iran showed with its two quite precise strikes on the U.S. air bases in Iraq that it is capable of hitting very sensitive American targets at a considerable distance. And these capabilities ought to be included in a future agreement.
Konstanz Stelzenmüller is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
As we just mentioned, the fallout from the Iran nuclear deal could result in sanctions on Iran. But Iran has already been under some kind of sanctions for years, and they've had dire consequences for Iran's economy and its people. The World's Shirin Jafari is here to explain. And Shirin, how have these sanctions impacted the Iranian economy?
Carol, experts say that Iran is experiencing a major economic crisis right now, with a large portion of the Iranian population falling below the poverty line. And just to give you some numbers on this, the inflation rate is close to 40%. One out of four Iranians is unemployed. And the International Monetary Fund estimates that Iran's economy is contracting at 9.5% every year.
That sounds really dramatic. How has it affected people's lives?
People are struggling to make ends meet. Just have a listen to what Sara Bazubandi told me. She's an Iranian and she runs a risk consulting company in the UK. She has also written about Iran's economy.
The price of red meat, the price of chicken, the price of fish, the price of bread, everything has increased by a few hundred percentage over the past few years. And considering that the salaries and economic activities inside the country are quite slowing down, people find it quite difficult to be able to afford various simple items that they used to be able to afford in their lives.
And Carol, that has led to a lot of frustration. Just a few weeks ago, the government announced an increase in fuel prices and thousands of people poured into the streets to protest.
Is it just the sanctions that's making Iran's economy so bad, or are there other things?
Well, there are several different reasons. One is domestic. There's mismanagement and corruption. But the sanctions are a big part of it. Iran has been under some sort of sanction for years. And this is nothing new. But what is new is the level and the intensity of these sanctions. Iran's economy relies a lot on oil. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran's oil exports. And so the countries that used to buy oil from Iran are no longer able to do so. In addition to that, the U.S. has sanctioned Iran's banking system. Iran is basically cut off from the global financial system.
What does that mean practically for Iranians, to be cut off from the international banking system?
What that means is that they are not able to make any transaction, trade, for example, import, export.
Now, the Trump administration has imposed all sorts of sanctions, like you said, on the banks, Iran's oil, even specific individuals. But we still hear that there will be more sanctions. What else is there to sanction?
So I asked Sara Barzubandi about this.
Oil sanctions pushed the Iranian government to try to find back channels to sell Iranian oil at sort of a reduction of the prices. And but they carried on selling oil to certain consumers. And what the U.S. government is doing now is trying to block all of those back channels as well. For example, recently I heard that they are having serious conversations with the Chinese government to force them to stop buying oil completely from Iran.
Carol, what Barzubandi says is that this is going to shrink the revenues of the Iranian government even further. That could mean that the government is no longer able to pay its employees, for example. And the public sector is a big part of the Iranian economy, by the way. And so things can get even worse.
So it sounds like the basic thing is the more sanctions, the less ability Iran has to do business with the rest of the world, and therefore less money, less hard currency coming into the country. Is that basically it?
Exactly.
But are there any exemptions to these sanctions?
The U.S. has always insisted that humanitarian goods like food and medicine, those are exempt from the sanctions. But I've talked to people inside Iran who work in the medical field, and they tell me that they have faced many problems when it comes to importing some medical goods. That's because of the sanctions on the Iranian banking system. So again, once you're not able to do any sort of banking, then you're not able to import anything. Sara Bazubandi, the expert I I spoke with put it this way. She said, because of these sanctions, many countries don't want to do any business with Iran, be it selling nuclear centrifuges or medicine. They just don't want to deal with the headache.
Wow, that's pretty comprehensive. The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Carol.
Russian hackers are at it again. According to an American cybersecurity company, military intelligence agents from Russia managed to hack into a Ukrainian gas company that's at the center of President Trump's impeachment. The World's Lydia Amanalidou has the story.
Area One is a cybersecurity company in California. Their entire mission is to stop phishing attacks. You know, the kind where people get a link in an email and they're tricked into handing over usernames and passwords. So a couple weeks ago on New Year's Day, researchers at Area One discovered a phishing attack that their CEO, Oren Falkowitz, says appeared to be coming from the Russian government.
Now, initially, like, we didn't think of it as anything particularly of interest. It's just, you know, there are a lot of these types of cyber attacks that happen every single day. But about a day or two later, you know, we noticed that all the companies being targeted were in Ukraine. They were all oil and gas companies. And when we look further, they were all subsidiaries of Burisma.
Remember Burisma from the impeachment story? It's the Ukrainian energy company at the center of the scandal. Joe Biden's son, Hunter, used to sit on Burisma's board. And last summer, Donald Trump asked Ukraine's president to announce an investigation into Burisma and the Bidens. Oren Falkowitz with Area One says the recent phishing attacks they discovered began in November when the impeachment story dominated the news in the U.S. Since then, he says the company has been able to link those attacks to the Russian military intelligence unit known as the GRU. That's the group U.S. officials say hacked and released the emails of Democrats in 2016.
You know, we have an expert team who follows Russian cyber activity and has developed the, you know, patterns and telltale signs of this activity and was able to correlate this specific attack not only to those patterns, but also to other ongoing campaigns being perpetrated by the Russian government.
Falkowitz says that his company has figured out that the phishing attacks against Burisma were successful. The Russians were able to trick employees into giving them their email passwords. As for what information they were after, what they got, and what, if anything, they plan to do with it, that's not clear at this point.
But we obviously do know that Russia has a history of hacking information and leaking it to damage a U.S. political candidate, because that's exactly what they did in 2016.
Jessica Brand is with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, and experts like her worry that we might see a repeat of the types of hack and leak campaigns we saw in 2016 when Russian hackers successfully targeted the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign using phishing attacks.
They stole information and they used that information by releasing it timed for maximum impact. One thing I worry about when I think about 2020 is the possibility of hacked material being manipulated. We know that at least one document that was leaked in 2016 was altered. And if the goal of these operations is to sow doubt and confusion, really, what better way to do that?
So what are U.S. officials paying attention to at this point? Here's Shelby Pearson in a speech just today. She's the top intelligence official assigned to election security.
This is not a Russia-only problem. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, non-state hacktivists all have opportunity, means, and potentially motive to come after the United States in the 2020 election to accomplish their goals.
The attack against Burisma, election security experts say, shows just how creative the culprits can get and just how many potential targets they have to choose from. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
And one quick note, we reached out to Burisma, the Russian government, and the Biden campaign for this story, but did not hear back by airtime. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Jobs, electricity, water, schools, and periodic eruptions of war. That's a partial list of the challenges that come with daily life in the Gaza Strip. But there are some signs of a possible deal being worked out by Israel and its longtime enemy, Hamas. One came this week when Israel issued 500 permits for workers from Gaza to enter Israel. The World's Ariel Osseron joins me in the studio to explain. And Ariel, talks have been going on and off for about a year now. Where are we now?
Yeah, that's right, Carol. So the talks started in August of 2018 after a summer that saw hundreds of rockets being fired at Israel and Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. Usually after these rounds of flare-ups, we'll see limited scope talks, but these talks seem a little different. They seem to be aimed at a longer-term truce.
That's kind of interesting, but who's actually talking to whom?
So it's important to understand, Carol, that these are indirect talks. But in this case, Israeli national security officials are meeting with mediators from Egypt, Qatar, and the United Nations. And those same mediators then move on to meet with Hamas officials.
So are they working out specific things between Palestinians in Gaza and Israel, or is this some sort of reopening of a greater Middle East peace process?
So sorry to disappoint, but the short answer is no. These are not talks about creating a Palestinian state or the two-state solution like we know. They're just talks about ending the cycles of violence in Gaza. Israeli officials have kept quiet about this until now, but there was a speech earlier last month by Israel's military chief of staff, Nadav Kochavi, that got a lot of attention.
ואנחנו נמצאים בתהליך בסיוע המצרים שבו בתמורה.
What Kochavi is saying here is that he sees, quote, an opportunity with Hamas in Gaza. And this opportunity essentially means if Hamas can bring more security, peace, and quiet to the border with Israel, then Israel will be willing to ease up some of its restrictions. Now, it's important to remember that about 2 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip in a situation that the UN describes as a humanitarian crisis.
So what are the actual specifics? What is being discussed?
Basically, what's been reported is that they're talking about reducing restrictions that have been in place on Gaza for over a decade. This includes granting permits to thousands of workers from Gaza to enter Israel, kind of like the move we saw just yesterday, expanding the fishing zone along the Gazan coast, and possibly a man-made island that will house a new airport and seaport. As far as Israel's concerned, what it wants to see is quiet on its border with Gaza. I spoke to Yaakov Amidror. He's a former National Security Council head in Israel, and he said this.
Quietness, which allows Israel to concentrate on the north, to contain the Iranians in Syria and in Lebanon. This is the highest priority of Israel today.
Amidror told me that this isn't really a full-blown agreement, rather an arrangement with Hamas in Gaza.
It's all kind of interesting, but Palestinians themselves are really divided, aren't they? I mean, what's going on with the Palestinian president? Is he involved in these talks at all?
So yeah, you're right, Carol. They're most definitely divided. In the West Bank, you have the official leadership led by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his Fatah party. And in Gaza, you have Hamas, which violently seized control in 2007. I talked to Mohamed Abusada from Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. He says that there's a lot of skepticism about these talks among Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and that they fear that these talks will lead to further friction among the Palestinians.
The Netanyahu government has switched gears and decided that probably it's better for Israel from a strategic viewpoint to strike a deal with Hamas, which will, in the meantime, undermine the Palestinian Authority and Fatah in the West Bank.
So what Abusada is saying here, essentially, is that Israel is pursuing a divide-and-conquer strategy with the Palestinians. I asked Yaakov Amidror about this. He's the former Israeli national security official. And he told me that while cutting a deal with Hamas might not be ideal, there's no one else to do it with because the Palestinian Authority is not in control in Gaza, whereas Hamas is the sole power there.
So where do these talks stand?
Like I said, there's nothing official about these talks, but from what we know from leaks to the press and other reports, they're in their advanced stages. But it's hard to see a deal put in place before Israel's election, though, coming up in early March. It's a very politically risky move, and things can fall apart at any moment with another round of violence. However, if this deal does go through, it would be a real change to the region.
The world's Aral Osaran. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
The big story in the UK today, well, it's quickly become headline news for our neighbors to the north, too. Canada will be the part-time home for the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, better known to most of us as Prince Harry and his American wife, Meghan Markle. But Canada is a big place, and where exactly Harry and Meghan will land is a topic of fevered speculation. The smart money is on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Here's the BBC's Jatinder Sidhu.
What will it be? West Coast, East Coast, Central Canada that they finally settle in?
They've been the talk of the town ever since reports started to emerge of Harry and Meghan's six-week sojourn on Vancouver Island. Canadian journalists say they knew all along where the Duke and Duchess of Sussex were staying, but they decided to respect the royals' privacy. You can get there on the Seabus plane from the harbour alongside downtown Vancouver, They were in North Saanich, a secluded part of Vancouver Island, about 60 miles or 100 kilometres from here. So how do the residents of British Columbia feel about having Harry and Meghan live amongst them?
I think it's fantastic. Canada is a very good, nice place to be. It's part of the Commonwealth. BC will be open arms. They would love to have them here.
I think it's good. You know, they want to feel more free and liberated. I'd probably do the same thing if I was her.
I think one of the things they like about Canada here is that we just don't care. We're very nice. We're very pleasant. They could probably walk around and not even get noticed out here. There's a huge group of people, celebrities and whatnot, that live here because it's some of the most beautiful country in the world, I'd say.
I think it's fine. If that's what they like, they should come. It's a nice place. They'll be a little less royal here. They'll still be the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, but not quite the same in Canada. So they should look to be being maybe a little bit more ordinary.
More power to them. I hope there are no sore feelings interpersonally or internationally.
It's a happening place for them. Why not? Mountains, you've got the ocean. Yeah, it'd be a good move.
There's some talk that the government of Canada might cover their security costs. What do you think of that?
I guess it depends on how much that security cost is.
$1.7 million a year.
Gee, that's a lot now. See, that kind of changes everything, right?
People are proud of the fact that the royal couple chose BC. It's not for nothing that number plates on the cars here read beautiful British Columbia. But as Shachi Curl from the polling organisation, the Angus Reid Institute, explains, Canada's feelings for the British royal family are mixed.
In British Columbia, across the country, those opinions are going to vary greatly depending on people's age, their level of interest in those two, and really their view about the monarchy and whether they see Harry and Meghan as working members of the monarchy, which of course this step back is intended for them to be less of that, versus celebrities that they might see on the cover of a magazine, in which case, well, there's always going to be that fascination, that curiosity about celebrity. But then when it comes to the question of who's going to pay for their lives here, particularly who's going to pay for their security, Canadians will have something to say, quite opposite or separate from their views of those two themselves, about paying for their lives here.
The BBC's Jatinder Sidhu speaking to locals on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. You're with the world. Migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. increasingly face long detentions, often separated from their families. The American system is not unusual. In Japan, the first Rohingya Muslim to be recognized as a refugee there spent a year locked away.
For what crime? What I did wrong in Japan?
We go inside Japan's immigrant detention system. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. The U.S. Senate will take up the impeachment of President Trump, with initial steps coming this week. The timing became clearer today when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced, on Twitter no less, that the House will formally deliver the articles of impeachment to the Senate tomorrow. The Senate will take up procedural formalities this week, with the actual impeachment trial of the president beginning next Tuesday. We at The World, of course, are focused on where the impeachment story started, Ukraine. And Ukrainians, they've got other things on their minds.
This topic is not so popular, not so much discussed, neither amongst politicians nor in press. People don't feel that it's like this topic has a tangible impact on them.
That's Ukrainian politician Svitlana Zalishuk, a foreign policy advisor to Ukraine's prime minister. She spoke recently with The World's Marco Werman.
Given how much reliance there is in Ukraine on the United States, is there perhaps an unwillingness to talk about impeachment because it might, I don't know, jeopardize the relationship?
I think that this is also one of the factors that has to be taken into account. But at the same time, there are many other problems here in Ukraine. First of all, we still have war with Russia. Many soldiers are fighting in the east. We still have casualties. And I think this is one of the problems that people do care. Another thing is, of course, all of the economic challenges that are there. The gas in Ukraine is really expensive, so people care about economic growth, about sustainability of the economy, just a possibility for the family to provide. That's the main topics that people are thinking about.
William Taylor recently stepped down as the interim chargé d'affaires in Ukraine at the U.S. Embassy. He served, obviously, as a key witness at the impeachment hearings. There's now a new person in that post, Kristina Kvian. How does the Ukrainian government see this changing leadership at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv? And what do you think it tells us about U.S.-Ukraine relations generally today?
The most important for Ukraine here is the bipartisan and bicameral support from U.S. to Ukraine. We see that both Democrats and Republicans, when it comes to decision-making in Congress, when it comes to security support, these decisions are there. It's also a political signal, a political message that there is a cooperation, that there is a support. And despite the fact of, let's say, not the most positive context of our relationship, the real cooperation is there.
Did you ever meet Taylor or even Maria Yovanovitch, the former ambassador?
Of course. I knew Masha Yovanovitch very well. Mm. She was an ambassador here while I was the member of parliament. That new generation, they came to the parliament after Euromaidan, relied a lot on the support of our international partners from U.S., from European Union. We had, if you want, kind of a coalition. Those progressives in the parliament and in the government, civil society, journalists, international people that supported progressive reforms in Ukraine, that was enough pressure to put on all the elites and on corrupt politicians so that they were not able to ignore this pressure or this public demand, including international demand for the changes after the Revolution of Dignity. And Masha was a very important person here in Ukraine, playing a very great role in coordinating those efforts amongst the diplomats and helping the new generation, basically, to make sure that reforms are implemented, that they are not stopped, that they are not stalled.
Now, several years after Euromaidan, an even fresher cast of politicians in Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky at the top, he's, of course, Ukraine's comedian turned president. Some Ukrainians have expressed doubt of not only his ability, but his administration's ability to lead. I mean, they are made up of younger, inexperienced politicians. What do you say to that?
I think that the changes that happened, they are really irreversible. What has changed? It was like a civilizational shift, if you want. Values of the society changed. It was not the elite who was leading the revolution. It was millions of people in the street that were protesting against not just the authoritarian regime, but against also corruption. And people wanted a better just rules. They chose the European integration, not just as a symbol of something, you know, beautiful and rich Europe, you know, but Europe with possibilities. But people chose a different system of governance. And that's why I'm sure that Ukraine, not anymore a swinging country, as it used to be referred to, but Ukraine is, if you want, a new Eastern European tiger, you know, with a very promising growth, economic growth. It's one of the most dynamic, actually, developing countries in Europe now. I think it will be even more. I think U.S. businessmen, U.S. people, American people, we hear about Ukraine as a new itinerary. And this is what this government is trying to achieve.
Svetlana Zalishchuk is the advisor to Ukraine's prime minister on foreign policy. Svetlana, great to meet you. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
The World's Marco Werman there. We'll be picking up the impeachment story tomorrow, looking at intelligence and national security issues. Now, here's a riddle. What do cement high-rise buildings have to do with revolutions? Author Viken Berberian answers that in his latest satirical graphic novel called The Structure is Rotten, Comrade. Set in Moscow, Paris, and Armenia's capital, Yerevan, the book follows Frunz, an aspiring architect bent on destroying the collective memory of a city. Viken joined me from Yerevan, Armenia.
I was just drawn to architecture as a trope, as a theme, and I admit I have a soft spot for cement, like Frunz, but unlike Frunz, there are many despicable things about him. I think what motivates him, and certainly his father, who is a builder, is money. They're very much open to the idea of demolishing the beautiful, historic homes in the city to make way for this urbanization and to profit from.
You started writing this book years before the revolution in Armenia in 2018 took place. I mean, what was your response to that? What did you think when that happened?
We kind of course, we started to write the book before the revolution, but it sort of all came together. There's certainly this unambiguous message in the title, The Structure's Rotten Comrade. Obviously, we're quite aware of political corruption, of corporate greed, what was happening here. So until we had this Velvet Revolution in 2018 that upended the era of the oligarchs.
Now, Viken, for our listeners who obviously can't see the book, the illustrations by French illustrator Jan Kebbia are very colorful and animated. It's like hundreds of colored pencils scribbled across the pages. I wonder why you decided on this style.
We both did not want to be constrained by genre or tradition. The illustrations are revolutionary in form and content. He breaks many of the classical codes of comics, the traditional talk bubbles, and the dialogue, for example, in our book does not have borders or frontiers. And Jan really knows how to capture comedy and pathos in a way that's not judgmental.
You and the illustrator Jan Kebbia started writing this book 5 years ago. Since then, there's been a lot of protests. You know, the world's kind of going through lots of upheaval. Do you view the book differently than you did when you started it?
No, I mean, the book is what it is. And the protests, I've always watched the protests, and I continue to watch the protests with consternation. Unfortunately, we don't see the same results, this movement towards more open societies in other parts of the world. And I'm hopeful that will change. And I'm hoping that the millennials, our kids, your kids, will be a part of that process. So that's why we actually reference The Little Prince in our book, too. I don't know if you came across The Little Prince towards the end of the book in the form of a graffiti on one of the walls. And I think the reason why The Little Prince is there is because we often forget kids in the larger discourse, and we dismiss them, but we should actually hear them out.
Viken Berberian is the author of a satirical graphic novel called The Structure is Rotten, Comrade. He's been speaking with us from Yerevan, Armenia. Viken, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
The simple act of an immigrant seeking asylum in the United States has increasingly resulted in long detentions, sometimes for months. That can mean family separations or protests like hunger strikes from within detention centers. And the situation doesn't just happen in the U.S. Reporter Matt Katz with WNYC visited Japan and sent us this report.
I want to start with birds. A bird can fly from here to there, cross borders without papers, without questions, without being detained. Outside of Tokyo, a scrapyard owner named Hutzal Min saw a bunch of sparrows living in his office, like nesting there, having babies.
Last year, 6 babies. This year, 6 babies.
The birds go out in the morning when his staff opens the doors and come back at night before the doors are locked.
They go out and they come back, they go out, come back.
Zaw Min fled his native Burma in the late 1990s after facing persecution by the military regime there. When he landed in Japan, he was immediately detained, imprisoned. He spent his first year in the country without ever even seeing what the streets outside looked like.
For what crime? What I did wrong in Japan?
This is how it is for many of those who fly into Japan asking for asylum. For Zaw Min, it took 5 years of legal fights, but eventually he became the first Rohingya Muslim from Burma to be recognized as a refugee in Japan, and one of the very few refugees from anywhere here. Zaw Min has a family here now and employs both Japanese and Rohingya at his 2 scrapyards.
Is the fact that you let these birds stay in your office, are they like your little like bird refugees? Is that too much?
Maybe. Because they have their life like me and you. I feel it is my obligation to help them.
An obligation to help was the premise behind the post-World War II United Nations Refugee Convention. The agreement was signed by most countries, including Japan and the U.S. But now, immigrants seeking safety from persecution increasingly end up detained. In the U.S., they're held in private prisons and county jails. In Japan, they're in federal detention centers.
Well, it's the immigration center, actually, and located in Shinagawa.
Rosa Barbarin guides me to where immigrants are detained on the outskirts of Tokyo. She's a student at Tokyo Sophia University, and she joins other classmates to trek here. They spend hours talking to some of the 500 men and women imprisoned on two floors of this building.
Congo, there's Mali, Uganda, Nigeria, there's a lot of Sri Lankans.
In the U.S., if you want to visit immigrants detained at Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities, you need to know the immigrant's ID number, and officials must pre-approve visits. But in Japan, visiting detained immigrants is much easier. Anybody can show up and ask to visit with someone to give them company.
These people, a lot of times, they don't even have friends that can visit them. Many times they can't even see their families, and they really, really need support.
Inside, we said hello to the detainees by pressing our hands to a glass partition. I wasn't allowed to record, but I took some notes. A woman from Uganda, Lupa, told me her life is at risk back home because of her Muslim faith. Lupa's husband went missing, and her father was killed. She escaped but was arrested as soon as she showed up at the airport in Tokyo to declare asylum. Outside, Barbarin and I talked about Lupa.
She's been in Japan for more than a year and has been inside this building the whole time.
Yeah.
She has never seen Japan.
She is not the only case. She could be working for the Japanese society. She's a mother. She has kids back home that she was hoping to bring someday to Japan.
I mean, that's just a common theme with all of these asylum seekers and refugees, the separation from family and particularly from their children. And you hear their voice change when they talk about their kids. You hear something changes in their eyes when you bring up their kids.
These stories are similar to what I hear in the States. Detainees in Japan complain about lack of medical care. That's the top complaint for detainees in the U.S., too. Both sets of immigrants also long for some regular outdoor recreation time. And then there's the most tragic challenge in both countries, mental health. Suicide attempts by detained immigrants are common, says Chie Komai. She's an attorney who represents detainees in Japan.
I go to the immigration detention centers. It's very important for me to say, keep on saying that, please do not commit suicide. Please survive. Please do not lose hope. Let's do our best together.
Last summer, 200 detainees in Japan went on a hunger strike, resulting in the death of a Nigerian man. In the U.S., the government now force-feeds immigrant hunger strikers through the nose. But while the U.S. has detained thousands of immigrant children over the last few years, that does not happen in Japan. Detainees in both countries are being held longer and longer these days. The government says the crackdown is because of fake refugees who try to game the system. Back at the scrapyard, Hatsaw Min sees it differently.
Refugee policy should be based on the humanity, not politics.
Refugee restrictions, he says, are more about keeping people out.
God created everyone the same, just the color is different.
Open the door, he says, and let the refugees in. For the world, Matt Katz, Tokyo.
Tomorrow, WNYC's Matt Katz heads to the outskirts of Tokyo, where sanctuary-style policies welcome immigrants, but with some limits. What if Jesus was gay and Mary was a pot smoker? That's the premise of a new Brazilian satire film, The First Temptation of Christ. Many in Brazil don't find the idea very funny. 2 million people have signed a petition calling for the film to be axed. The production company was attacked with Molotov cocktails, and a judge temporarily banned the film. But Brazil's Supreme Court overturned the ban. Reporter Shannon Sims has been covering the story. Shannon, Brazil's Supreme Court recently ruled that this film could stay on Netflix. Is that the latest on this case?
The Supreme Court, in an opinion, said that essentially Catholics can handle the satire and that protected under the Brazilian Constitution is freedom of speech. So currently, it's allowed to be on the air, but obviously this has created an air of tension in Brazil.
So who is the group that attacked the comedy group's offices in Rio de Janeiro?
Good question. All that we know is that a video was posted shortly after the attack claiming responsibility for the attack, kind of in a similar way that we see with attacks in the Middle East, where it was masked people speaking into the camera saying that they were the ones who had done this.
Wow, they masked their voices and everything.
Yeah, it's a pretty creepy sounding video.
Now, I understand that incident is being described as a terrorist attack.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should put this into context. Brazil hasn't suffered a terrorist attack in the same way that the U.S. or Europe has. And that is even when they've hosted the Olympics, they've hosted the World Cup, they've had, you know, the world stage and many opportunities, and fortunately have never experienced a terrorist attack. And so a lot of people in Brazil are saying, look, this is the first one. This is, you know, people throwing Molotov cocktails to explode a production studio and potentially kill people in the middle of the night in Rio de Janeiro. So, you know, this has caused a lot of concern.
The comedy group that produced the satire, Porta dos Fundos, how have they responded to all this?
They're taking it really seriously. You know, I was really lucky because I was able to get an interview with Antonio Tabet, who he is one of the founders of the group. And I would kind of equate to kind of like a Lorne Michaels, the Saturday Night Live creator figure in Brazil. And so I was able to speak directly with him about kind of how they're feeling about what's going on.
We continue to work with our kind of comedy after the terrorist attack, but we have stricter security standards. Unfortunately, if you cannot feel safe in Brazil on normal days, imagine today with a government that foments acts of violence and has not even spoken out about the first terrorist attack in our country after redemocratization, because the government has allies in church. It would be more or less like a Nazi group bombing Saturday Night Live headquarters in the middle of Manhattan, and Trump didn't speak out a line about it because it agrees with the attack and has allies among those who support the terrorist action.
So, Shannon, he's referring to Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro. What's his response been?
Bolsonaro's been quiet on this, and that's part of what is very upsetting to Antonio. But what we're seeing in Brazil is a real friction between two sides of the country. The country's really split in half right now. We saw that in the election, and we're seeing it now and how it plays out in these freedom of speech moments. So part of the country is really rallying around conservative concepts of the family, of Christianity, of sexuality. And then the other part of the country says, hey, this is Brazil, we're liberal, you know, no, LGBT rights are super important and all of things like that. Really, what this discussion is about is a very essential crevice in Brazilian culture right now.
What's next for Porta dos Fundos? I mean, are they kind of cowering, or are they saying, hey, this is what we do and we're just going to move forward?
They obviously have, you know, repudiated these attacks. And of course, they are, you know, as Antonio said, having to take security measures, which is absurd when you think about it. I mean, just going around in Rio, I run into the comedians of Porta dos Fundos at different bars at like 1 a.m. So, you know, they're just regular young people trying to make comedy out there. And now it's like they're in the crosshairs. So that's extremely unfortunate and saddening for anyone who is a fan of their show.
Reporter Shannon Sims, she's been covering the story of a Brazilian satire film, The First Temptation of Christ, and the huge controversy it stirred in Brazil. Thanks a lot, Shannon.
Thanks, Carol.
And finally, big news this week from the online universe. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Odds are someone in your family is a big YouTube fan, which means they've likely seen videos of Dutch makeup artist Nikki de Jager.
Hello, guys. It's me, Nikki. I'm using a black pencil on the lid. This is a party in a pan, and I want that party translated onto my cheekbones. I love makeup so much.
Her channel, Nikki Tutorials, has nearly 13 million subscribers. That's more than the number of Twitter followers Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have, combined. Now, the beauty guru is making headlines for a new reason.
It is time to let go and be truly free. When I was younger, I was born in the wrong body, which means that I am transgender.
De Jager came out as a transgender woman in a 17-minute video yesterday. The video is trending at number one on YouTube in the U.S. It's also trending in the UAE and Saudi Arabia, where LGBTQ lives are criminalized. Over 18 million people worldwide have watched so far. De Jager says she decided to come out because someone was trying to blackmail her.
I've always wanted to share this side of my story with you, but under my own circumstances, and it looks like that chance has been taken away from me. So today I am taking back my own power.
De Jager is 25 years old. She told viewers that by age 8, she wore only female clothing. She started taking hormones at age 14 and was fully transitioned by age 19. other YouTubers in the beauty and trans communities are expressing their support.
Nikki Tutorials coming out as a transgender woman. One of us, yes. What you did today means the world to so many people. You're changing lives.
It's just so, so important for people to hear that it's not defining to who you are as a person. So
Dutch politicians are also paying attention. Ingrid van Ungelshoven, the Dutch Minister of Education, Culture and Science, said, "You are really free if you can be who you are. Role models are of great importance for emancipation. Nikki Tutorials is such a role model." Deauger took to Instagram today with words of gratitude.
The incredible amount of love and support and warmth means so much to me. Thank you.
And to those who can relate to her journey, Deauger says,
"If you feel like you're trapped and there's no way out, know that it gets better. Trust me, it gets better."
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
That's where we leave things today. But you can connect with us first thing tomorrow morning in your inbox. Our morning newsletter, Top of the World, starts your day with fresh details from stories we're covering from across the globe. Sign up for Top of the World by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman will be back in the host chair tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.